October 13th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the Central Coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on our program, we'll be taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. That's in the second half. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. In the first half, we'll be doing Geek News with the geeks. The geeks today are Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe. And Ben is a web developer and world traveler. Hi.
Hiya.
It's been a pleasure being off for 2 weeks, and I've missed talking to the Central Coast of California, I have to say. So it's been both.
And last week, the Central Coast definitely missed you.
I don't think they thought about it after the first 10 seconds or so. So, I was listening to the show that you edited together for last week, and I actually liked it quite a bit. The podcast is good. It's shorter by 20 minutes, but it's really good.
Not by 20 minutes.
It's more like 30 minutes, I think.
So. In any case, thank you so much for covering the show for 2 weeks. I think that was the first time I've done 2 weeks off intentionally. And in, 11 years, something like that, we had a war, and we were off air for a while before the war. But other than that, and that wasn't my intention, by any means.
No, I'm pretty sure I've done a couple in a row. It's just that they weren't you completely off, and they weren't necessarily planned.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, let's go ahead and start with the geek news, and I'm going to start with a shuttle update, because why not? We just heard the NPR feed, and it's talking about the shuttle, so
yes, indeed.
You got something else to say, Ben?
Podcast listeners have no idea what we're talking about, but
right.
Radio listeners, they just actually covered this briefly. But yeah, the Space Shuttle Endeavour today and yesterday is being moved for the last time. Now, I covered this on the show, 3 weeks ago or something?
I don't believe you anymore, Ben. You say that every week.
No, right. Every single episode of Geek Speak, I start it with the shuttle being, it's a sad day. But a couple weeks ago, the shuttle was being flown somewhere for the last time, and it flew over California. Did you guys see it by chance?
I was teaching a class at UCSC, and I heard this giant rumble of the building, and I looked up, and I was like, that's a lot more impressive than I thought it would be.
You saw
it? Oh, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Right there. It was great.
Yeah, I went to Moffett Field. We saw it fly over Moffett Field. It was awesome.
Well, since I was up on the hill at UCSC, and it was in a kind of relatively tall building, I got to see it like go over Santa Cruz, over the wharf, and then pan around down south near Watson. It was great.
I didn't know it was going to Santa Cruz, but I was at Moffett Field, and I saw it kind of take off in the direction of the mountain.
What we're talking about is the shuttle was put on a large modified 747 and flown around California, basically, and kind of a tour, goodwill mission. And then today it's
farewell
being...
Mission.
Yeah, farewell. Goodwill?
Goodwill.
It's not good.
Donating clothes.
But now it's in its last leg today.
Yes, indeed. It is being towed down down a couple different large streets in Los Angeles on its way to the museum that it's going to end up in.
Now,
the science museum.
These are the streets they had to cut trees down for, right?
They did have to cut down a good number of trees and take down power lines and things like that. They responded to some of the criticism about cutting down trees by saying that they'll plant twice as many trees in their place. Of course, it's kind of, apples and oranges. It's good that they're making that effort. At the same time, it's a bummer they have to cut down the trees. But at the same time, how do you get a shuttle from LAX to a science museum? You kind of have to make a lot of room for it. So
they were apple and orange trees.
Exactly.
Let's go on. Is there anything else about it?
No, I'm just. That's the end.
The thing it's going to a museum. I mean, you can go experience it. You probably can go touch it. I mean, it's not like it's the end of the world. But I have to say, I was, with all the hype that you've been doing, giving it, no offense, I wasn't that excited to see it fly by. But when it flew by, I went, that's the last time it'll ever be outside.
Airborne,
And that's kind of it had an effect on me.
This thing has battle scars,
you don't remember
too.
The shuttle starting, that program starting.
No, I do not.
Miles, do you remember the shuttle program starting? I remember the first launch, being in grade school, and we went into an assembly room.
Yeah, it seems to me. I remember the first flight of, or at least I remember the first flight of Columbia. They had experimental flights before that that I don't remember.
But you were born after Star Trek Next Generation, right, Ben?
When did Star Trek TNG? No, that was 87. No, I was born
Speaking
before.
Speaking of TNG, do you know about the TNG _ S8? Twitter handle? I think that's the Twitter handle.
S8 season. Yes. Okay. So just to explain for people who aren't Star Trek geeks. So Star Trek is a series. There were seven seasons of Star Trek: The Next Generation. It's a television show, sci-fi television show. And so some people put together a Twitter username called Star Trek The Next Generation Season 8, S8. And it's all of these bizarre plot ideas that are completely ridiculous, but also incredibly stereotypical. Like,
It's they basically are writing a real-time Twitter feed of episodes of the show. Well, we'll have to link to the episode, but link to the GeekSpeak website, which is, by the way, is geekspeak.org. Everything we talk about goes up on geekspeak.org pretty much real-time now. At least it can if any of us do it. Sometimes we do it after the show. But why don't we go on to the next news story while you're looking up the Star Trek Next Generation thing, Ben?
I'm reading them and laughing them as well.
Good.
Right now.
Miles, do tell.
So, Jurassic Park?
The movie. Probably also happened before Ben was born.
Great theme.
it's not going to happen.
Oh, you mean we're not going to be able to resurrect dinosaurs from their DNA inside of amber-encased blood inside of mosquitoes? That was the major plot. By the way, spoiler alert.
Well, it's a pretty new movie. I really am that young, no.
As it turns out, what some researchers have found is that DNA has a half-life, and they found exactly what that half-life is. And under optimum conditions, the half-life of DNA is 521 years.
Oh, that's pitiful.
To show what a half-life is, because some people will know, a half-life with radioactivity means that if you have a radioactive substance, then half of the radioactive elements in there will have decayed to its daughter products.
During that period of time. And that breakdown pattern is one of those structures of reality that we kind of think is kind of cool. I mean, I always think it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That if you have a pure product, a pure type of element over a period of time that we define by half-life, it'll be half as pure over a period of time. Carbon does that, for example. That's why we have carbon dating. I'm oversimplifying.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of those things where I know scientists go,
carbon.
Yeah, that's not carbon, the same. Never mind, we'll let it go.
Yeah, carbon 14 decays back to carbon 12, and the proportions between them is how we date things.
Right. But in any case, with a really complex molecule structure like DNA, and we're talking about not an atom decaying, we're talking about giant strands of molecules.
What does that mean? DNA.
Well, when you say giant, I guess in length of atoms or length
of
molecules.
Well, millions of atoms, I think.
It's still small.
come on. Okay, chromosomes. Yes, they're small, but there's lots of molecules. Lots of atoms.
So after 521 years, half the bonds in the nucleotides have broken.
Okay, so.
Oh, I see.
So half the bonds of the nucleotides of, like, if you had one cell, if you will, of some creature, and it's got its chromosome stack, and therefore it's all genetic makeup in these long molecules, what you're saying is half of those in 500 years are just destroyed. Or are you saying if you had 50 cells, half the cells would be no longer viable?
No, half the nucleotides would be...
Okay, that's depressing. That's,
well, it's just like with half-lives with radioactivity.
Sure, it's molecular levels.
Let's say you had, hypothetically, you had 100 of these radioactive elements.
Right.
Then, and they had a half-life of 2 weeks.
Then in two weeks,
you would have 50 of them, and then the other 50 would have decayed to a daughter product.
But you're talking about there a very simple, an atomic level simplicity of one atom versus another atom. The difference is very simple. What I'm talking about is a large molecular strand. You could say it's different by just cutting it in half. But what you're saying is it's no longer viable. I mean, none of the bonds are viable, or the bond itself breaks down over a period of time. So that's the details that we don't necessarily know. But the point is that after 500 years, it's half as hard and again and again and again.
Right.
If you're talking about 2,000 years, maybe you could do something. But we're talking about a lot longer than that for dinosaurs, unfortunately.
Yeah, I just did the math. It's in the – I think – of course, I got rid of the number before I am reading it now. But something like 2 to the 500,000 power or something like that.
We're not going
to
see
one
it.
Over that. Right. So, yeah, it's ridiculous.
So
you
that does make
generate your new organism at that point.
Yeah, you might as well just define it yourself.
Just
right?
get a computer. Infinite number of monkeys to start typing ACTG.
Yeah. and then you get Shakespeare, right?
So,
DNA encoded Shakespeare.
Now, I've heard that we probably would have the ability to resurrect, if you will, the species of mammoth, right? Mammoth is close enough to elephant that we could have a relatively simple womb. We could actually make a viable cell and put it in an elephant and have an offspring of a mammoth. That's a possibility in the sense that, well, we're only talking, you know, we're not talking that much time.
How much time since the mammoths? Well, it's been a really long time.
There are dwarf mammoths that were on an island that lasted quite close to our current era, you know, in the 4,000 year area, I believe. I'd have to research
really?
That again. So we're not talking about that long ago.
Okay.
And then the dodo bird, of course, is another candidate of something that we've lost. The one that I'm interested in is another cousin to the human. I mean, wouldn't it be cool if I never can say the word.
Oh, my cousins are still alive.
Oh, good. Okay, well, we can clone them.
Australopithecus?
No, the one that's closer than that, isn't it?
Cro-Magnon?
Cro-Magnon, yeah.
Or anyway. Cro-Magnon, whoever.
Anyway,
you want to talk.
Let's move on to the next news story. And that's it. Thank you for telling us that fiction is still fiction.
Yes, and
specifically that story is all about how the DNA is not going to be viable for dinosaurs. We will not be able to reincarnate them like that.
Well, we won't be able to recreate them that way.
Oh, we can just take a bird and get it really really close to
we can make stuff up and try to find the same morphology.
I was going to say, when you said, yeah, it's not going to happen, period, I thought that's very un-Miles-like of you to say something like that. But to say it's not going to happen that way, that's very different, right?
For all intents and purposes, it's not going to happen.
But we do technically have a lot of DNA from dinosaurs, right? We have all the cousin offspring, you know, all the grandchildren of dinosaurs and the cousin offspring of dinosaurs. And theoretically,
examples, not necessarily anything that's a direct descendant of Tyrannosaurus Rex, for example.
Right. Yeah, but couldn't we just modify a bird and have it turn into a dinosaur, like that episode of Star Trek, Ben? You know what I'm
On the contrary,
about?
Birds are already dinosaurs.
Everybody devolved and Barclay was a fly.
Yeah.
But that was scary. That was really scary.
Birds are fairly prehistoric. I mean, you look at them, they're kind of dinosaurs.
You're speaking as a chicken owner, I can tell. Totally, I feel that way all the time.
I was thinking the turkey, because it's a larger animal, and you see some more of the definition in their legs and stuff like that. You're like, that's...
We have, you know, it's been too long since we've talked. We're just going on about all these different things. Let's get back to space, Ben, shall we?
Get back to space. All right. So I want to talk about another space-faring vehicle. So we just talked about the shuttle being retired and, you know, moving for the last time today. Well, SpaceX is a private company which has kind of replaced NASA's role of getting things up into orbit, like to the International Space Station and whatnot. And they've been actually immensely successful. They have the Falcon 9, which is actually just launched on October 7th, actually. So that would be just last Sunday, 6 days ago. And it got up successfully and was deployed all of its cargo, docked with the space station, all that stuff. But if you watch the slow motion launch, there was actually an anomaly, and they actually lost an engine as they were shooting themselves up into space. They actually lost an engine. There's a little explosion, and you can see it. The really cool. So everyone's thinking like,
whoa, wait, they lost an engine and they still lost an engine orbit and everything.
Yes. So
wow.
Here's something really
cool. My car is not that good.
Right. Well, wait, your car has rocket engines?
I have 4 engines in my car.
Okay, so...
Well, there definitely is fire coming out of the tailpipe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so this is like the 30-second mark, right? 30 seconds into the launch, they lose an engine. They still get up to orbit. So, I mean, if you lose an engine 5 seconds into the launch, there's no way you're going to get up, right?
You don't know that. You're not a rocket scientist.
Well, a rocket scientist wrote about it, actually. So, but they have 9 engines on this thing. So it's not the couple of engines or the few engines that they've had on other launch vehicles. They've got 9 engines. So one of the engines failed. It turns out that depending on when the engines fail and in what situation, they can actually lose up to 2 engines and still make orbit.
Wow.
And their computer on board, I mean, the Apollo computer was like, I don't know, had the CPU power of less than my phone from 5 years ago, right? But these rockets have fantastic computers on them, so they can actually on the fly recalculate their trajectory and re-aim the rockets and get themselves into orbit no matter which one of them fails. It's really phenomenal. So a lot of people are saying, well, this is a failure, you know, like how can we trust a private company if they have an issue like this?
Well, it sounds
rocket
like
science
they designed
is hard, though.
Yeah.
It's like it's good. Really, really hard.
I like that. That's the episode of today's show. Rocket science is hard.
Rocket science is hard.
With the though. You need the though at the end. But wait a second. So what you're saying is, with the thing is that the design of the craft, that it had nine engines, that it had some redundancy, seems like
redundancy.
A better way to design.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. So people are saying it was a failure, it sucks, whatever. But I'm thinking, like, good on them, you know? Yeah. They put nine engines in this thing instead of seven or eight.
For space travel, I think a failure is the object hitting the planet at a higher velocity than was intended, or, I don't know,
like
the ship blowing up,
yeah.
the entire ship blowing up before it leaves orbit. Yeah. I mean, there are disasters, and then there are...
Or you overshoot, and then you're...
you bounce off an atmosphere and go
into space. You leave the orbit completely. Right, but the point is that they did a pretty good job. They achieved their mission with a failed engine.
They did. So one of the questions is, like, what if an engine fails more catastrophically?
Yeah.
What if it blows up the craft? Or what if two engines fail? I mean, like, it's not...
One engine failed and the entire craft just, you know, didn't work? Like, it seems to me that they did the right thing by designing it with redundancy. And now they have the opportunity to improve their engines without any loss of life or anything.
Exactly.
Was this manned?
These are completely unmanned. It was just a whole bunch of cargo and stuff, and they had solar panels.
So cool.
Yeah, so just really, really neat, though. I mean, it made me really happy to know that, like, I read... SpaceX Falcon 9 lost an engine on the way up, and my heart skipped a beat, like, oh God, what happened?
So the Falcon 9,
but it made it.
The Falcon 9 SpaceX craft, what happens to that after they're done? Do they take it back to Earth? They leave it up there?
I think they recycle them.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure they recycle
them. That's
pretty cool. Yeah, so they bring them down in parachutes and all that stuff. But anyway, so that's really good news, and some people are saying it's a failure. I think it's kind of a success. It's not good, but...
Let's go on to another story.
Successful enough.
I hope this one's good. Thank you very much, Ben. Miles, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
So a couple of legal decisions I'm just going to shoot out rapid fire. One of them is that the U.S. Supreme Court has stated that the immunity law on wiretapping, warrantless wiretapping... that was put forth by a lower court will stand. It's...
What do you mean the immunity law? What does that actually do?
So after AT&T and others were caught
handing
data off to the NSA for domestic calls, not just for international, and without
warrants,
the Bush administration at the time then moved toward having a retroactive immunity, saying
you couldn't sue AT&T for...
And the Obama administration continued this policy.
Right. And the hope, of course, from us people that want things to work fairly, was that over a period of time that immunity would go away, and they'd have to use search warrants to collect that kind of information on U.S. citizens. And what you're saying is it's going to stand, which means that the federal government could keep on doing this with phone companies, and probably are.
And they probably will. And the idea was plaintiffs arguing for the executive branch were saying that warrantless and suspicionless domestic surveillance should occur without fear of review by the courts and at the sole discretion of the attorney general.
What?
Now, if you...
This is not... There's a checks and balances. Do you remember that? Do you remember that whole thing?
Hey, man. Don't talk to me. Talk to the Supreme Court. I personally have issues with this on its face, but there's also that issue of, do you also trust the next person who takes the White House?
It's not about that. It's about, oh man.
Well, for some people, it's like, well, it's okay right now. This is
a trying time. There's a war on
that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but do you trust it for 3 presidents down the road, because now this is going to be...
See, this is the time. This is the time of year that I get so depressed about politics. All the politics is just ridiculously bad. No one's talking about that. Like, that is important. It's important that the federal government can decide to just start listening to your phone calls willy-nilly without any review, and only one branch has to do that. I mean, basically, you're just ridiculous.
Well, in other news, the South Carolina Supreme Court has stated that your email that lives in the cloud doesn't qualify as electronic storage and therefore is not protected by the Stored Communications Act.
Wait, what data?
your email.
Is not considered what?
So if you you have a Gmail account, let's say.
Okay.
And
I do have a Gmail account.
If you read your email, in other words, you copy that email down to your system, that means that you are controlling now the storage of it. It is not general electronic storage.
So if I'm using a mail app, for example, to access my Gmail account, it's downloading those.
Oh, on the messages. Contrary, even with a web browser, because it's copied to your web browser's working memory.
Okay. All right.
And because of that, you are not in control of that original copy anymore. That is just an extra copy.
Right.
And is not... does not qualify as electronic storage like it would if someone had their own email server and then all the mail came into there. And
so because you're not actually controlling the server that's storing your mail, it isn't your, like, it's susceptible to being read, or like, what exactly are the ramifications of that?
The Stored Communications Act would allow certain protections, and both for privacy and for data integrity. And mm-hmm. those don't, according to this ruling from the South Carolina Supreme Court, so that's going to be limited to that state for now. But at the same time, jurisdictions right. are really odd when you're talking about the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the phone story that we just covered a minute ago, the government story, excuse me, that we just covered a minute ago, reminded me of a phone story that I wanted to talk about. So I just did a little lookup because it did upset me when I heard this. Yeah,
before we'll, you get into that, I just want to finish off with the fact that the Ninth Circuit of Court of Appeals has stated the exact opposite of that that South Carolina Supreme Court case.
Okay.
So expect to see this going to the Ninth Supreme Court.
The Supreme, okay.
No, the Ninth Circuit is us.
Okay. Thanks.
That's our area.
So. All right, cool. Thank you for that update. This last week... this story is from October 9th. I'll link it to the GeekSpeak website. Verizon iPhone owners have 30 days to opt out of sharing local search data and more with the advertisers for Verizon. So this is the deal. Right now, Verizon can know, if you're a Verizon customer, they know everything about what you're doing on the web. They might not know the actual data traffic if it's HTTPS, but they do know everything else about what you're doing, what sites you're going to, what ads you're seeing, what if you're going to Facebook. A lot of data can be consumed by your cell phone carrier. And basically, Verizon is saying, if you don't want us to take that information, your private data that we're collecting on you, and share it with our advertisers to therefore make better advertisement and make better money, you need to actively opt out. You need to go up to our website, log into your Verizon account, and actually, I think it's a privacy setting, say, I don't want to participate in this system. And it's the My Privacy section of the Verizon's website. So if you're a Verizon customer, either of you Verizon customers, Miles or Ben? Okay. So
and
it doesn't.
I won't be with this.
Yeah, you'd think that they're really kind of horrible, right?
Oh my gosh.
Guess what? AT&T does this too, except that for AT&T, you have to fill out a form. So what we're saying is.
Oh no.
We're going to have more information about this next week. With very detailed instructions on how to do this. But right now, the data that gets collected by your cell phone, which is a very personal device, your location information, for example, all the time, because you don't need to have GPS on your phone, as Miles mm-hmm. is always telling us. You don't have to have GPS enabled or anything for your cell phone carrier to know where you are. Your cell phone carrier always knows where you are. It's easy for them.
Yeah.
You're identified.
Roughly.
They can triangulate you. It's pretty easy for them to determine where you are. And therefore, they know where you work, even if you only have your home address with your cell phone carrier, because you spend a lot of time at work. You know, I mean, what your phone is kind of a link to where you are all the time and what you do online. You know, if you're looking at a movie review, they can make an assumption that you like that kind of movie, right? And they can determine what movie you're researching by your phone access data. So, because the URL space is not protected in most cases for a lot of things. So, use HTTPS, but we won't talk about that exactly. But basically, go and complain to your cell phone carrier that you do not want that information shared outside of their company. You're already paying them. I mean, I'm paying, you know, close to $100 a month on my cell phone. I don't need them to make more money off of my data. And that's not part of the bargain in my perspective. Now, of course, they define the terms of the contract. I can either accept it or walk away. And that's the only power
I've
got.
And to play devil's advocate, they're making money off of this, obviously. So if they don't do this, would they charge more?
They might. But at the same time, couldn't they just say, here's what that's worth to us? Like, why don't they just say that? Your data has this much value if we sell it. Do you want to you want to protect it, or do you want us to sell it?
Because that's not how capitalism works.
Right, I know. It's kind of
capitalism is how much are you willing to pay for it?
Anyway, the sad thing at first is that I was all upset about this because Verizon, I'm so glad I'm with AT&T, and I find out it's actually harder to get out of the process with AT&T. I'll be researching this week to do it myself. I'll document that, and next week we'll cover a little bit about how you can learn to opt out. For Verizon, it's pretty simple. You just have to go into your Verizon account, if you remember your password and all that, log into their site, and My Privacy section.
So I wonder how this implement, or I wonder how this affects T-Mobile.
I know, because there's kind of subs, right?
Sprint consumers,
I know.
People like Credo Mobile, who have really, really great, at least more... they're more liberal, right?
Well,
AT&T is very, very conservative, but they use the networks of the
these
big companies.
Yeah.
So where, like, what happens there?
Yeah.
Okay, I do have to jump in there. I think it's very dangerous to think of corporations as either liberal or conservative.
Okay, well, we'll say the with the money.
I wasn't going to that branch, Miles, but I did see it happen. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, they're not people. So
No, they are.
Oh no.
Yeah. That's a gross oversimplification. But
I agree. But I know what you're saying, that they're not as nimble as these smaller companies. They're going to do things in a larger way, and therefore what they entrench and do kind of stays more stable.
And they'll also end up being far more schizophrenic because of so many people that work for them.
Right. Sure. Right. There won't be a good understanding of what the right thing to do is. But the point is that if AT&T and Verizon are both making this default assumption they can sell your data unless you tell them not to, then the other companies are going to fall in line. Or one of these other cell phone companies is going to come along and go, hey, you know what? Part of our service agreement with you and part of our rule is we're going to hide your data as much as possible, and this is how we're going to service you, and it might be a different fee or something. But that would be a good selling point.
That was the allure of Google Plus when Facebook was Facebook was still this, right?
But isn't Google Plus doing ads too now?
I'm sure.
Anyway, let's just take a little break to mention that you're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. You can call us with questions and comments about technology. We can answer anything you'd like. I'll give out that information again. I'll give that phone number in just a minute after we go to some geek bits and all that. This is 88.9 KOSP, kosp.org. You can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Ben, geek bit?
I do have an awesome geek bit. There's this really cool photograph that an astronomer on the International Space Station took of, and you can see Earth in the background, as most of these photos are. And you can see the International... I love Earth, too. I live there, actually. You can see the International Space Station's solar panel, and then these three mysterious cubes that are just floating there in space. And they look like really, really small Borg cubes.
Like Minecraft tiles?
Like Minecraft tiles.
I'm addicted to Minecraft.
They're about 10 centimeters or 4 inches on each side. They're cubes, and their mass is about a kilogram, maybe a little bit more. And they're actually called CubeSats. It turns out that there are these things called CubeSats, which you can send up into orbit along with they're pretty lightweight, so you can actually build it and send it up into Earth's atmosphere. Into Earth's orbit for well under $100,000.
So,
in terms of space exploration, they're very, very cheap, and you can do a lot of cool stuff because you're in
space.
When
you support a Kickstarter project to launch one of those. Pretty cool.
Yeah, they're so cool.
And awesome. So there's a great photograph of that, and it'll be on Geek Speak just a second. I made the show live, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking, Tesla Roadster, CubeSat. Tesla Roadster, CubeSat.
So the Tesla is, of course, the very expensive, high-performance electric vehicle that costs, something like $100,000.
Yeah.
So you can put a box up in space doing something for you.
And they were still selling them. They're not
selling. That's pretty cool. So you can put a box in space that does something, or you can drive a car.
Well, good
That's
luck.
A tough decision.
Good luck finding a science grant to buy you a car.
Well, let me ask you. If you had $100,000 and you had to choose one of those two things, which one would it be?
Neither.
No,
I get the car.
You get the car, right? Exactly. You can resell the car easy. Let's.
That's a hard one for me.
Miles, another geek bit. Visual news story. It's best on the website.
It's not necessarily visual, but it's long lasting enough that I can't really talk about it at length on air. And that is the computer science behind Facebook.
Ooh.
Facebook has a blog where their engineers talk about what's going on behind the scenes, I highly recommend that. But if you need something a little bit more accessible than that, like a little halfway point, I highly recommend a Bloomberg Business Week article that I'm going to be posting up on GeekSpeak after the show.
Is this how the business works or how the tech works?
No, this is when certain technical issues come up, how do they react to that and what are the technical challenges that they had to solve it into layman's terms.
Oh, that sounds like a wonderful article. The GeekSpeak episode's live now, so if you add it, we'll be able to see it immediately. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to definitely read in on that. I'll mention a book that I've been enjoying quite a bit in the last few days. I'm about halfway through. It's a very small book. Actually, I think I started it yesterday. And it's called JavaScript, The Good Parts by Douglas Crawford. Miles
Crockford.
Crockford, sorry. Miles, when I pulled this book out, you said, yep, seminal work. Perfect book.
Yeah.
Now, I also have, you know, a few versions. I think that's version 8 now of The Definitive Guide, also by O'Reilly, JavaScript Definitive Guide. Which is really, really big and crazy and has a lot of stuff. In fact, the most recent version has a whole section on jQuery, which is a library. It's like, I don't know. What were you going to say about that book?
I was going to say that book also has all of the cruft that ever existed in JavaScript back to Netscape.
Right.
2,
and therefore, if you are a programmer that not hasn't had a lot of experience with JavaScript, maybe done a little bit, but you're stuck in some other hellscape like Perl, or you're having a lot of fun with an excellent program language like Ruby.
Hellscape of Perl? Come on.
Come on. Come on.
It's like that. I still like Perl.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah, you go sit in your corner then. But. Or if you're having pleasure in Python or Ruby, or you're still stuck in PHP. In any case, you have some programming experience and you haven't spent the time to really get good at JavaScript, this book is the way to do it. It's a skinny book. It's thick as my thumb. It's less than 150 pages long.
Yeah, it's very succinct.
One of the things I love about this is this whole train tracks diagrams of the language. So you can kind of imagine if you were to have a sentence in English and you'd have a noun and a verb and you tried to write a path through a sentence, you could loop through a whole bunch of nouns, right? Because you could make a list of nouns. And if you loop through more than two, you should add an and commas. So that whole rule, you can actually visually diagram with these kind of railroad diagrams, which I know JavaScript pretty well, relatively well. So I love looking through the language and kind of understanding the visual aspect of the language. I definitely am a visual guy, so it's a lot of fun to look through this. So go down to your favorite bookstore, pick up the book, JavaScript the Good Parts, flip through a little bit, and I would be surprised if you don't buy it. It's by O'Reilly and Douglas Crockford. This is the first book on Geekspeak I've done for a long time that wasn't sent to me. I actually went and bought it because I couldn't figure out how to get it from O'Reilly for free because of GeekSpeak. I just went and bought it. And I got to say, I'd buy two of them if there were two. All right.
Good luck using two of them, though.
Yeah,
for yourself.
Exactly. No, I would. I have one at home
for the office.
Yeah. It's a good book.
Regarding that book, you were talking all about the diagrams and how cool they are, but even without the diagrams, that was the book that I was reading in all of my downtime last time I was traveling through Europe.
Oh.
So I spent the night in Terminal 5 of Heathrow. That place is like a church. It's so fantastic, the audio quality, but I couldn't sleep. And so I just walked back and forth, reading JavaScript, the Good Parts, on my Kindle. It's a really cool experience.
The wonderful thing is it is referenceable and not just, it's great to read and it's referenceable. It's just fantastic. But, I will say that if you're not an experienced programmer to some degree, that's not the book for you. If you're not the experienced programmer, I'm going to recommend another book, and I'll do that next week because we don't want to stack up book reviews too much. Let's go ahead and mention that you can call in. I haven't given the phone numbers enough. I will do it a lot. The phone numbers are 1-800-655-5877. Again, nice and slow for humans, 1-800-655-5877. 655-5877. We can take any calls with questions and comments about technology. If you heard something on the show at any time and want to talk about it, welcome to do so. If you have a question about your computer or what kind of iMac you should buy, please give us a call. We can assist you. The phone number again is 1-800-655-5877. We'll do some news as we're waiting. I think it's your turn, Mr. Jaffe.
Yes, indeed. Speaking of personal opinions and things that cost money, but we all like them, I love the Kindle. I am such a big fan of my Kindle.
And I
cover it relatively often, all the updates and things. Amazon recently released a new Kindle called the Kindle Paperwhite, mm-hmm. which is supposed to be brighter, and then the darks are darker, and it looks more like paper and all that stuff. So it's interesting that Amazon is now it hasn't actually shipped yet. Amazon is preemptively...
Yes, it has.
Yeah, it's
shipped.
It has? The white?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
there's reviews all over the place. Yeah, go on.
Oh, okay.
Including in my house.
You have one?
Oh, nice.
Yes. So the Paperwhite, what's really funny about the Kindle is that this whole support of like a Kindle, you don't need backlight, it's bad for your eyes. That was like a lot of selling point because you can use the Kindle in sunshine, right? Like unlike a lot of other portable devices. The Paperwhite has a backlight. So what do you think, Miles? Is it hard on your eyes at night?
I bought it for Becca, so I don't use it primarily.
So you've never seen it?
Come on, you spent the
first half an hour with it, right?
Yes, that's actually what happened. But,
of course it did.
And also setting it up so that it connected up to her Amazon account and not to mine, because I ordered it as a gift for her, and then it showed up already logging into my account. I'm like, no, I don't want
That's kind of cool. I mean, that you were about to buy it and it already set up the login.
Yeah, it's already set up when it shows
up. So when you buy it, even if you're shipping it to yourself, check the little, it's a present thing. So it doesn't do that. But if you're giving it to someone else.
But at any rate, I did notice that I definitely wanted to turn that backlight down. The brightness as it starts off with, I thought was way too bright. And then if it's really dark at night, because like during the day, like you don't need the backlight. It's right. It looks great. And at nighttime, you can have the most meager of backlight and it'll just look like you have a light on behind behind you. And it looks quite nice.
Yeah. Okay. Human eyeballs are very good at capturing photons. So you don't really need a lot of it. Anyway, so Amazon is basically preemptively, or not preemptively quite, but disclosing some of the shortcomings of the Kindle Paperwhite. And they did this a couple days ago just to get ahead of consumer complaints. One of them is that the backlight is not entirely
even.
Even, yeah, exactly. Like the bottom, it's kind of a little weird. I mean, I don't know. That's not really a problem for me, but apparently some people were complaining about it. The other thing is it has less storage and things like that as well. So they actually released a statement. This is interesting to me. They released a statement saying, hey, the Kindle Paperwhite is awesome, but just so you know, it has some less storage and da-da-da-da-da. So that way when people are buying it, they know.
The thing about the Kindle line is there's so many of them, it's confusing. Like we all understand what we're looking at.
Yeah.
But they've got the tablet that still has the Kindle term, but it's not a Kindle. It's a tablet. It just has, Kindle Fire.
The Kindle Fire. Yeah.
Fire. And it's like, that's a tablet.
The
it's a totally
Kindle
different
Plasma.
Thing. Yeah. It's frustrating to me that that they make it so complicated. Now, the other thing I've got to ask you, Miles, you've played with the Kindle. Ben, you've played with the Kindle a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I have an avid reader friend who reads, a book every other day, kind of, paperback every other kind of day. And she has told me that she can read faster in a paperback book. She goes through a lot faster than on the Kindle. She actually recently read a book in the same book again, and it was slower on the Kindle. Why? Her assumption was had to do with the way she reads a paperback. She's able to scan it faster and read less effectively, but get the gist of it than on the screen.
I think I would probably agree with that because the Kindle, you only see one page at a time. You don't see both pages next to each other.
Yeah.
So,
but you also don't see see the whole page? Is it comparable to a paperback page?
I think it is. Yeah.
There is a delay also when you turn the page, right?
There's a delay.
And you can't keep reading.
It's not super huge of a delay, but I would definitely believe that you would maybe be 10% slower reading on the Kindle. But I mean,
that's the kind of percentage you're seeing.
I do love actual books. I really love actual books. But when you're traveling, or if you just throw it in your bag or whatever, it's nice to be able to carry the five books you're reading at the same time all with you.
I freely admit that there's an economic reason for me to have purchase this for my partner.
She would buy so many books.
She's an avid reader, and she purchases a great deal of books. And the lower cost of a Kindle book, it will pay for itself within 10 books.
Really?
Basically. Because the Kindle books are
always... If you're buying books all the time.
Yeah, are so much cheaper that if you... if they're $10 cheaper... And you buy 10 of them, you've paid for the device.
There's one last thing that I want to throw out there as well. The other part of this story, or at least the other story having to do with the Kindles this week, is that Amazon's Jeff Bezos did recently admit, and he hasn't been talking about this before, but he did actually admit that they sell the Kindle pretty much at cost because they make all of their money on Kindle book sales and things like that, right?
Right.
So that was kind of an interesting thing to hear as well. So if you're buying a Kindle, it's as cheap as it is because it's actually pretty much at cost.
That and our house isn't that big.
That's true.
No, we have so many books and no place to put them. And so we prioritize which books we have out in the shelf in the living room. And then the other books, they end up getting put into storage.
Now, do you keep a library of books after you've read them?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know who could have used a Kindle? Harry Potter. He lived in a cupboard. No room in there.
From Santa Cruz, the west side of Santa Cruz, Wendell, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have an iPhone 5 and an iPad, and I am always looking for good apps. And I was just wondering if there was a general consensus among you guys as to what you would consider the most important app, the one that you can't live without, and also your favorite app.
Awesome. Let's do it. Two apps apiece. Your favorite app and the one you can't live without. Miles?
Well, so that's the thing, though.
You know the rules. No, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, my favorite app, honestly, is the email app that comes with it.
I was going to say the same thing.
So it's not really... I that's not really, I think, what you're asking for. You're asking for what are the apps that you add on to it. Am I correct?
Correct.
Okay. I would say there's an RSS reader that I have. So a feed reader, that's where I get a bunch of my news from.
Okay, for the iPad.
What is it again? Could you repeat that?
He's going to look up the term. The app that I use on my iPad a lot, and I have to use a stylus with it, is called Art Studio. It's a drawing and painting app. I love picking up the iPad and drawing with it with a stylus. So if you have to do the stylus. Stylus is really cheap. Like I got a pack of like 12 or something for the iPhone and iPad for like $6 on Amazon or something or one of those online stores. So the stylus is not that expensive. And Art Studio is the app. It's a paid app. I'm not sure how much it costs, but I use it enough that I like it. For managing my life, I use a thing called OmniFocus, which is like a task management system, and I have a version of that on my Mac. I have a version of that on my iPad and a version of that on my iPhone, and they all sync together through my web server so that as I add a task or a shopping list or whatever, it syncs to my device and I can see it. So my partner might have the iPad at home and add something to get at the store. And so when I'm driving by that store, my phone will go, bing, you're in the area to pick something up, and I can go into the store and see my shopping list. That's an app called OmniFocus. It's actually a pretty expensive suite of apps, but I use it so much to define how I deal with my life that it's like I use the TDD method task management? TDD is test.
RTS, no.
I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, getting things done. Thank you. Thanks, Miles. So those are some apps that I use. Ben, you're not an iPhone, but you've got apps.
I'm
too.
On an Android device, and mm-hmm. if I have to only do two, I would say Beyond Pod, because that's how I listen to Geek Speak, right?
Okay.
That's a podcasting one, and then so that would be one of my most useful. And then my favorite, although it's not particularly useful, I don't drive a lot, but there's an app called Car Matey. And what happens is you park in a parking spot, you open up Car Matey, and you drop your anchor. And it remembers where your car is parked.
Does it pay for your meter, too?
It does not pay for your meter. Man. And then you can, you know, find it back. There's a compass view, which looks all antiquated. There's also a map view. And then also you can share your car's location, which will send out an email to whoever you want that says, ahoy there, my car is parked at blah, 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 blah.
So you like it. Do you ever use it?
It's just, it's funny.
Okay.
It makes me smile every time I use it. So I use it all the time, yeah.
Miles?
The other one I had was... that I spend entirely too much time on is the Craigslist app.
Oh, yeah.
So
which one?
Craigslist Plus or Craigslist Pro Plus.
Yeah.
And
that's the one you can actually post from as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I spend entirely too much time looking at the free stuff. And
well, you do have a pickup truck and land.
Yeah,
I mean,
but
those
mean,
two
not,
things.
But it's not just that. I mean, there are things that could fit in,
yeah.
you know, in a standard car, but it's along the lines of, oh, well, you just look at the listings and like, oh, yeah, I was going to get one of those and now it's free, so.
Nice. Does that help you at all, Wendell?
It sure does. Those are interesting apps. I'll check them out.
I was aware of two of them, but
I'm always looking for free apps, but
yeah.
you know, I'll pay if I think it's worthwhile.
Okay,
real last quick question.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real simple one. I think you guys will know the answer. And I've been really having a hard time playing my voicemail on my iPhone 5. Is there some trick to getting that work? I can't seem to get the voicemail.
Well, you should have bought a phone. Everyone knows you don't use your phone to actually communicate.
Miles is joking. I would go to either Verizon or AT&T store and say, nah, and point at it and grunt until they fix it. But it should be working pretty effectively. One thing I recommend is do sync your phone, your iPhone, to a computer through iTunes. It'll help you manage the device a lot easier. Mm-hmm. They you can do it all through the cloud. You don't have to ever sync. You can sync through the cloud and all that. But if you do connect to your computer, you can manage a little bit differently. I'm not familiar with using the iPhone without syncing it through a computer. I think of it as an ancillary device to some degree. I know that you can operate completely without that. But it should be in the settings that set up the voicemail. And I haven't set up a new account and a new voicemail in at least 5 years. So I don't have the answer, but I think that any of the phone stores that sell the phone will support it. In fact, probably the AT&T store would support the Verizon phone if you went in there and said, please help me, because it's the same type of settings. But if you could go to the one, also the Apple store would do the same thing. And I guess that's probably the easiest way to get it to work.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Tech support is one of those things where, yeah, we can all figure it out, but it's really hard to describe it on the radio.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Mostly because we don't really know how to do it. We figure it out as we go. I don't know. It's kind of interesting conundrum. So that's what I would recommend. Head on in.
Okay.
And we'll go
thank
ahead and
you very much.
Certainly. We'll go ahead and put a list of these apps that we use on the GeekSpeak page. So it's geekspeak.org. We'll go ahead and add some links or at least some titles so you can search for them. All right?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. If you'd like to call in, like Wendell, and anywhere you're calling from, you're welcome to call in from the United States and Canada, toll-free, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. We are live 10 to 11 on Saturday at the Pacific time every week and have been doing so for years. So if you're a podcast listener and you want to call us, go ahead and tune in at that time. You've got to figure out your time zone. But we'd love to have a call.
I had a quick... note, I was thinking the other day about why people are so resistant to buying applications on the phone. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, 99 cents for an app versus free. 99 cents. You go and you buy a Starbucks coffee, that's four apps right there. And yet, there's so many people, like I was talking to actually a friend of mine who develops apps, and he created a paid version of his app and added new features so you could pay for the new features. He didn't change the free version. But everyone got really upset. You know, like they got really upset
because.
Was it
an Android app?
No, it was. It was an Android app.
Yeah.
But.
They've actually found that Android users are much more price sensitive and much more resistant to buying it than.
Although
Apple.
That's
well,
true.
They make, well, because clearly by definition, they make better decisions about their purchases. As an iPhone owner, sorry. Speaking of podcast apps, though, I can't stand the new Apple podcast app. And the biggest thing is, I listen to podcasts almost completely. I don't listen to music. I don't even like Beats. But when you use your phone with the newest OS, if you haven't used the phone for a while and you push the play button on your headset, if you will, it'll start playing the music player rather than the podcast you're listening to. That default setting seems to be kind of stuck, which is kind of frustrating. But maybe we should stop talking about apps.
It's
to some
probably
degree,
better than the Maps app, though.
You think?
I think so.
All right.
The new Apple Maps app?
Well, you know, like as Miles and Alex were saying last week, it's pretty good for us California people.
Well,
it's
that's
just,
true.
It's just
that's
not
true.
So good in the rest of the world, right, Miles?
I'm fine with it.
Maps are hard, though.
I don't think Apple was really ready. I think it was a bad decision. But it has been, I mean, it started working it. It's useful in other applications, like the OmniFocus app I use. The crossover worked, and the new map started working, and I was able to do what I needed to do. But in any case, let's go ahead and go to Santa Cruz. Christine, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a teenager. He's 16, and he goes to public school, and they don't teach anything about computers there, and I was wondering what you guys recommend about how to get him more computer savvy. I mean, he knows about games and all that, but just knowing more about, I think he's going to go into physics or engineering, so just wondering how I can get him more educated in computer stuff.
Is he interested?
Yes. Yes, he is.
Okay. I mean, does he have another life? Because the thing with us was none of us had lives outside of geekiness, so we just I couldn't kick a ball, I had to play on my computer.
Well, there's actually a term for that.
Oh, yeah?
It's programmers go through what's called a larval stage. No, I'm not making this up, where you start learning about it and you just sit in a room and start coding and hacking stuff together. And
see, the reason why Miles is a better programmer than Ben and I is because Ben and I also had theater. Right,
so there's
you had some theater. I've seen you act. You had some theater, but we didn't do the tech side of theater very much, though. Right. In any case, I think the larval stage of programming does make sense. There are some great classes locally that are just incredible, and there's some amazing apps and books out there for having a lot more time in your life. I mean, there's just we had a review a few weeks ago. My son came on, who's turning 11 in a couple days, and he's read this book called Scratch Programming. Scratch Programming, I think it is. That's an environment that's really easy to program in. That's a little too young for a 16-year-old, I think, but maybe not. But there's also I'm going to recommend my friend Chris Young's business, Downtown Santa Cruz. He's actually in the same building as Cruz.io, which is one of our underwriters. And Chris has the Maker Factory, and it's basically a space where you can go do 3D printing and milling, all this really cool technology, computer to physical stuff. But he also teaches up at UCSC classes on 3D modeling and game development, and he also offers those courses, well, not the same courses, but the same type of things for students as an after-school program down in his space. And that kind of stuff exists all over the place.
Yeah.
So I would kind of recommend signing up for a class. Just like if you wanted your son to learn how to be a martial artist, you take him to a class. Their classes are there. I would recommend that.
Yeah, I highly recommend the class aspect, because if they don't have a class, we just say, like, hey, here's this game engine. Because both Ben and I have taught kids how to program computer games. Is that fundamentally programming is frustrating.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, it is insanely frustrating. And you must be either, like, in a routine and having other people with you doing
to
it.
To get you through that hurdle.
Or you have to be interested in the end result enough.
Or you have to have no other life and have no other choice, like us.
Well, no, I mean, it's that idea of, I want to have a website that does X, Y, and Z.
Right.
That is a great way to learn how to program, because you have a goal and you have a desire to do it on your own. If you don't have that, it's really hard to get someone into it.
I mentioned Chris Young's business of Maker Factory and how he's teaching, and I like him. He's a good guy. There's a lot of people that are doing that thing, and I want to recommend that anybody that teaches or does stuff in that space in Santa Cruz, greater Santa Cruz area, Central Coast of California, actually, please feel free to email us. That we will put it up on the show page for today's show. As you send in your, I teach this, I teach that, we'll put all of it up. I'd like the community at large to have more resources of this nature. Ben, the academy that you do, that you teach at still, what's it called?
Digital Media Academy and Academy X are the two companies that
I
teach.
And they're at Stanford and they have locations.
One is
locally?
Stanford and also all over the U.S., different universities. Academy X has locations in San Francisco.
I know you have to leave right after the show, but would you mind putting links to those, to that stuff on our page later today when you have a chance?
Absolutely.
Does that help at all, Christine?
Yeah, it kind of does. I think the game aspect of it,
you know,
the boys are so interested in games. So maybe design. Game.
Yeah, and the game space is very difficult, but a lot of the engines that actually run the games are hackable and playable. Like the Minecraft space, I would say, is really great, because it's not that hard to install a module, to see the source code of a module, and actually do new things in the game. Like, my son was playing Minecraft last weekend, and I went ahead and hacked together some JavaScript that allowed him to shoot a laser beam and basically remove blocks, right? And it was only a few lines of code, and in fact, I copied that code from somewhere else, right? I didn't actually code it, I did a small change, but that idea of, like, kind of being able to modify something that they can play in, is really neat. And Minecraft's a great plague space for that, because the game itself is as much about building and creativity as it is challenge.
Yeah, but be sure you make the distinction between someone who really likes playing games and someone who likes making games, because they are very different animals.
I also recommend that we have events up at UCSC. The game program is really quite good. The graduate program I work for is associated with the game program, and it's some amazing resources up at UCSC. So there are some public things you can go to as well. We're running out of time. Email us, too, please. Celebrating 40 years together, this is 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Thank you, David. And to Geeks Today, we're Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe, and answering the phones was Rick. Thank you all for participating in GeekSpeak with me. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you next week for KUSP and for GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. And one more reminder, please, we are available through email, geeks@geekspeak.org. You can also go to our website to learn more about the show.